Talk Radio 790 KABC. Peter Tilden at 10 continues hour number two. Brought to you, of course, by Larry Miller and Sit and Sleep. It'll be anyone's advertised price. Your mattress is free. We're waiting for former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson to speak after being fired this morning. It seems to be by tweet by the president to make room for his new team. I'm guessing in preparation for North Korean talks. The timing is kind of interesting. We'll take your calls about that. 800-222-5222. We'll go to that live when it happens in just a moment. But I also wanted to be joined by Paul Musgrave, who's assistant professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Good morning, Paul. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
It's beautiful there. I got married at the Lord. Is it Lord Fletcher Inn there in Amherst?
Yes, it is. It's just down the Lord Jeffrey.
Lord Jeffrey, there you go.
Our town's genocidal founder.
It's a beautiful town. So let's talk Rex Tillerson up until he speaks, and then I'll either put you on hold so you can listen with me, and we'll comment some more. You had mentioned in an article that he's near the bottom of the list of secretaries of state. Others weren't even as generous as you. Others who worked in the State Department in the past said he's definitely the worst because he's gutted the State Department. He's isolated himself with a bunch of folks that aren't really, they don't know Washington and they don't know diplomacy. So give me your insight into this. Why would you think that his achievements are few? I guess he was also competing with Jared Kushner and policy by tweet.
I think that you hit on it exactly. I think that Rex Tillerson in no universe was ever going to be one of the best secretaries of state. I just don't think that he had the temperament or the sort of broad-minded approach to diplomacy that you need. But I think that his relationship with a White House that is fundamentally dysfunctional to the point of being unable to run a consistent or coherent policy doomed his administration from the start. And so I think the question is he the worst or merely one of the worst secretaries of state of all time? And when you start asking the worst, you have to think about people back in the 19th century that we don't really remember. So over the past century, he's my pick for the worst.
Wow. And is that because, you know, you got a guy, when he was going into the job, people were hopeful because he had, he was world-traveled, the mainstream GOP foreign policy experts, even Robert Gates, picked him, and Condoleezza Rice praised the pick, saying this guy has dealt with Russia, he knows the world, he's done business all over the world, he gets the geopolitical stuff that's going on. They thought he would do a great job. Where did it, and he had a relationship with Putin, and this administration especially wanted to have a relationship with Putin. How did it fall apart so quickly?
I think this is a question we're going to be talking about for a long time. I think there's a lot of ways in which the secretary went wrong. For one, he never had a good relationship with the people in the State Department. And a lot of secretaries come in and they want to change the way that the department does business, and I think there are reasons that you might want to do that. But you can't alienate everybody top to bottom and impose literal physical distances from yourself and the people who actually do the work of diplomacy and expect to be successful. So from his beginning, Tillerson was doing exactly that, annoying, irritating, dismissing, in some cases firing or even humiliating people who are long-serving diplomats. And that just left him with no base of support in the department. The other thing that I think Tillerson had was a set of impulses on diplomacy, on foreign policy, that were actually kind of sound. They actually were that kind of establishment, quiet vibe that you were talking about. But that does not fly in the Trump administration. And so he found himself on the other end of a lot of impulses from the president who conducts diplomacy by tweeting.
Also, you got to wonder, I mean, we looked up his net worth. His net worth is around, $300 million. This guy doesn't need the gig.
He's
set for many lifetimes. So it's an ego thing and a want to serve the country thing. So you take this job and pretty quickly you find out that this guy named Jared Kushner is kind of undermining you. Steve Bannon has a say in what you're doing, and you're supposed to be the top dog. Isn't it all supposed to emanate from you and your conversations with the president?
This is exactly the right way to think about this. For decades, ever since the end of the Second World War, the White House whoever was president has always tried to take a big hand in the shaping of U.S. foreign policy. With the Trump administration, that has moved to an almost unimaginable degree of centralization. You know, President Trump has said that on foreign policy, he is the only person who matters. And so for Tillerson, you're always going to have the structural problem of being a cabinet secretary, physically outside the White House, trying to push your agenda. But in other administrations, there are ways to make that work. in the Trump administration, where policy can be made by whoever happens to be standing in the Oval Office, you do not have a policy with which you can engage. And so Tillerson tried for months to become a good friend to the president, to have dinner with the president, to influence the president. None of that worked. And so the number of serial humiliations kept piling up and piling up. And I'm sure we all remember the debate last summer over whether the president or Tillerson had a higher IQ.
Oh, yeah.
Reports that Secretary Tillerson in a closed-door meeting had said that, and I know we're on broadcast, the president was an effing moron. Those are really the sorts of stories that you don't hear anywhere else, and they reflect some real tensions that are always inherent in a president's relationship with his Secretary of State, but dialed up to 11. I mean, this is just unspeakable, unimaginable level of dysfunction.
Do you think this happened now because of, you know, the North Korea thing is so big to this president, to all of us, that he wanted to have a new State Department and pecking order in place to make sure that they're on the same page so he goes over there or prepares to go over there in the right way, because there's a lot that has to be. Oh, you know what? We got a break. We'll get back to you, Paul, Tillerson's talking right now. So let's go right to that.
Noon time from Air Force One. And I've also spoken to White House Chief of Staff Kelly to ensure we have clarity as to the days ahead. What is most important is to ensure an orderly and smooth transition during a time that the country continues to face significant policy and national security challenges. As such, effective at the end of the day, I'm delegating all responsibilities of the Office of the Secretary to Deputy Secretary of State Sullivan. My commission as Secretary of State will terminate at midnight, March the 31st. Between now and then, I will address a few administrative matters related to my departure and work towards a smooth and orderly transition for Secretary of State Designate Mike Pompeo. I'm encouraging my policy planning team and undersecretaries and assistant secretaries, those confirmed, as well as those in acting positions, to remain at their post and continue our mission at the State Department and working with the interagency process. I will be meeting members of my front office team and policy planning later today to thank them for their service. They have been extraordinarily dedicated to our mission, which includes promoting values that I view as being very important. The safety and security of our State Department personnel, accountability, which means treating each other with honesty and integrity, and respect for one another. Most recently, in particular, to address challenges of sexual harassment within the department. I want to speak now to my State Department colleagues and to our interagency colleagues and partners at DOD and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, most particularly. To my Foreign Service officers and civil service colleagues, we all took the same oath of office. Whether you're a career, employee, or political appointee, we are all bound by that common commitment to support and defend the Constitution, to bear true faith and allegiance to the same, and to faithfully discharge the duties of our office. As a State Department, we are bound together by that oath. We remain steadfast here in Washington and at posts across the world, many of whom are in danger-pay situations without their families. The world needs selfless leaders like these, ready to work with long-standing allies, new emerging partners and allies, who now many are struggling as democracies, and in some cases are dealing with human tragedy, crisis of natural disasters, literally crawling themselves out of those circumstances. These are experiences that no lecture hall in an academic environment or at a think tank can teach you. Only by people going to the front lines to serve can they develop this kind of talent. To the men and women in uniform, I'm told for the first time in most people's memory, the Department of State and Department of Defense have a close working relationship where we all agree the U.S. leadership starts with diplomacy. The men and women in uniform at the Department of Defense, under the leadership of Secretary Mattis and General Dunford, protect us as Americans and our way of life daily, at home and abroad. As an all-volunteer military, they do it for love of country, they do it for you, and they do it for me, and for no other reason. As Americans, we are all eternally grateful to each of them, and we honor their sacrifices. The rewarding part of having leadership and partnerships in place is that you can actually get some things done. And I want to give recognition to the State Department and our partners for a few of their accomplishments under this administration. First, working with allies, we exceeded the expectations of almost everyone with the DPRK maximum pressure campaign. With the announcement on my very first trip as Secretary of State to the region that the era of strategic patience was over, and we commenced the steps to dramatically increase not just the scope, but the effectiveness of the sanctions. The Department undertook a global campaign to bring partners and allies on board in every country around the world, with every embassy and mission raising this to the highest levels. And at every meeting I've had throughout the year, this has been on the agenda to discuss. The adoption of the South Asia Strategy with a conditions-based military plan is the tool to compel the Taliban to reconciliation and peace talks with the Afghan government. Finally, equipped our military planners with a strategy which they can execute, as opposed to a succession of 16 one-year strategies. This clear military commitment attracted the support of allies broadly and equipped our diplomats with a whole new level of certainty around how to prepare for the peace talks and achieve the final objectives.
Talk Radio 790K, ABC, you're listening to outgoing Secretary of State Rex Tillerson.
Work remains. In Syria, we did achieve important ceasefires and stabilizations, which we know has saved thousands of lives. There's more to be done in Syria, particularly with respect to achieving the peace, as well as stabilizing Iraq and seeing a healthy government installed, and more broadly in the entire global campaign to defeat ISIS. Nothing is possible without allies and partners, though. Much work remains to establish a clear view of the nature of our future relationship with China. How shall we deal with one another over the next 50 years and ensure a period of prosperity for all of our peoples, free of conflict between two very powerful nations? And much work remains to respond to the troubling behavior and actions on the part of the Russian government. Russia must assess carefully as to how its actions are in the best interest of the Russian people and of the world more broadly. Continuing on their current trajectory is likely to lead to greater isolation on their part, a situation which is not in anyone's interest. So to my colleagues in the State Department and in the interagency, much remains to be done to achieve our mission on behalf of the American people, with allies and with partners. I close by thanking all for the privilege of serving beside you for the last 14 months. Importantly, to the 300-plus million Americans, thank you for your devotion to a free and open society, to acts of kindness towards one another, to honesty and the quiet hard work that you do every day to support this government with your tax dollars. All of us, we know, want to leave this place as a better place for the next generation. I'll now return to private life as a private citizen, as a proud American, proud of the opportunity I've had to serve my country. God bless all of you. God bless the American people. God bless America.
Talk Radio 790 KABC. That was it. The outgoing Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, whose reign will end on the end of March. I'll get back to Paul Musgrave. I want to get your calls, too, 800-222-5222. We didn't pick it up from the first second, but I didn't hear him mention the president at all. Did he thank the president, President Trump? Did he even mention him in this thing? I don't think so, unless I'm incorrect, but I'm pretty sure he didn't. He did talk about Russia, and that if they continue on the road they're going on now, this trajectory, there's going to be more isolation. He also seemed far-clamped, out of breath, or not irritated, but kind of in a weird state. I guess he's just processing the whole deal. Maybe he was totally blindsided that he didn't know today he'd be giving that speech. But he talked about the State Department, talked about the South Asia strategy, talked about ISIS, talked about how important the allies and our partners are, talked about China and our relationship going into the future, what that's going to look like, because we have so many issues with China and intellectual property and price manipulation and tariffs. But he didn't shy away from talking about Russia, like I said, talking about North Korea, the success there. But it seemed like he was stressed. He did not seem relaxed at all, but he just seemed stressed. He was breathing heavily from the entire time and looked like he was really not in not in a good way. And I guess nobody is when you're leaving that unexpectedly, although we've heard that it wasn't unexpected, that it was talked about for a long time, according to the president. All right, I'll continue with you and Paul Musgrave, assistant professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, because we didn't get to finish our conversation because of the news conference. And he didn't take questions, as you know, he just got out of there. So gone, he's finished, and he's going to kind of hand over, delegate to his deputy, Sullivan, and wait for the approval of the next Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. All right. Talk Radio 790 KABC. Peter Tilden at 10 continues right after. Talk Radio 790 KABC. Peter Tilden at 10 continues. Phone number 800-222-5222 if you want to comment on Rex Tillerson's press conference. He didn't mention the president. Didn't say I'm honored to serve for him. Didn't hear that once. Paul Musgrave is with us, assistant professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Thanks for hanging while that speech went on. What's your take on that, Paul?
I think that you had it exactly right before the break. The real story here was that Rex Tillerson was trying to give his classy statesman-like speech on the way out, and at every moment he was doing everything he could to draw as great a contrast between his performance and the performance of the president as he could. This was a speech about foreign policy, about honor, integrity, about even going after sexual harassment, and about public service in a way that's loyal to the Constitution and in a way that is selfless. None of those are things that would apply to the president.
So it was in your face speech.
It was very in your face. And I think there are a lot of people on the left who would wish for him to have been even more honest and outspoken and to have like hoisted a resist poster while he was there. But that's not Rex Tillerson. He is a Republican. And I think that the silence there is damning. And this also does suggest that some of those folks in the Senate, Corker and McCain and others who have been pockets of opposition within the Republican Congress to President Trump, may see the confirmation hearings for the new CIA director and the new Secretary of State as a way to show some backbone.
Going to be interesting. Now, back to Tillerson for a minute. 60% of the state's top-ranking career diplomats resigned. 60%. And new applications to join the Foreign Service fell by half. That's like, if you're looking at baseball, that means you have no farm team coming up for the next couple of years. It takes you a long time to rebuild. Is that the situation we're in?
I wish that it were. This is not a situation like the Astros where they tanked for a couple of years and then came back and won the World Series. I think this is going to be more just a steady brain drain of talent and idealistic people moving away from the State Department, which is being starved of resources, which is being starved of leadership, which is being starved of presidential attention. I think that this is a weakening of the State Department that will have ramification for years or possibly even a decade to come.
Paul, is that because
pessimistic analysis.
Is that because when you're new to the White House, you don't understand that political appointees shape policy? That they're the ones who sit down with you, have been in the trenches forever, and it's not entry level. They've been doing this a long time, and they can tell you the personalities. They can tell you the problems. They can tell you the subtext. They can tell you the nuances, stuff that would take you a long time to figure out. Is that how diplomacy works?
You've got it exactly right. And there was a deep-seated fear in the Trump administration when they came in that they would be undermined by these shadowy, nefarious deep state forces. And so they turned on a lot of the career people who, honestly, even though almost none of them voted for Trump, wanted to go in and do what's right by the Constitution to implement the policies of the Trump administration, because that's what they signed up to do. And they wouldn't have done that enthusiastically, but they would have done it. But from January 20th, 2018, from that bizarre inaugural speech about the American nightmare, President Trump and in the Secretary and in the State Department, Secretary Tillerson, worked to undermine the career officials and tried to work around them. And the results have been obvious and disastrous.
Paul Musgrave, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Thanks for coming on with short notice. His website is paulmusgrave.info, and the Twitter is at Prof, P-R-O-F, Musgrave. And we'll talk to you again when we have a little bit more time. And thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Talk Radio 790 KABC.
KABC News is live and local at 11:30. I'm Jeff Whittle. President Trump fired Secretary of State Rex Tillerson today and said he wants to replace him with current CIA Director Mike Pompeo. And Tillerson just spoke about his ouster at the State Department.
I received a call today from the President of the United States at a little after noontime from Air Force One. And I've also spoken to White House Chief of Staff Kelly to ensure we have clarity as to the days ahead.
Tillerson also appeared to choke up while discussing his departure.
Effective at the end of the day, I'm delegating all responsibilities of the Office of the Secretary to Deputy Secretary of State Sullivan. My commission as Secretary of State will terminate at midnight, March the 31st.
President Trump is now on his way to California, his first trip to the Golden State since taking office. This afternoon, he'll view the border wall prototypes that have been built east of San Diego before arriving at LAX at 3:35 p.m. so he can attend a Republican Party fundraiser tonight in the Beverly Hills area, even though the exact location has not been announced. And Trump is expected to spend tonight at the Intercontinental Los Angeles Downtown Hotel near Wilshire Boulevard and Figueroa Street, where some streets have already been blocked off, and tomorrow he'll fly to St. Louis. And the man accused of gunning down Pomona police officer Gregory Casillas at the end of a chase on Friday night was charged today with capital murder. That murder charge against Isaias de Jesus Valencia of Pomona includes special circumstance allegations of murder of a police officer and murder for the purpose of avoiding or preventing a lawful arrest, which could make him eligible for the death penalty. Talk Radio 790 KABC Sports. L.A. Kings shut out the Canucks 3-0. So L.A. moves ahead of Anaheim into third place in the Pacific Division, while the Ducks lost to the Blues 4-2, and Anaheim's dropped 3 in a row. Lakers host the Denver Nuggets tonight at Staples Center. Clippers visit the Chicago Bulls this afternoon. College hoops. UCLA takes on St. Bonaventure tonight in one of the NCAA tournament's play-in games. Cal State Fullerton faces Purdue Friday morning. That's sports on the home of the L.A. Kings, 790 KABC. Traffic, a market check, weather, and more. Tilden at 10 next. KABC News Time, 11:33.
Talk Radio 790 KABC, Peter Tilden at 10, hour number 2 continues. Hey, you know what? Since he's playing Jackson Browne, and he's Southern California icon, he's going to be at the Greek Theater August 4th. You want to go see him? Dino's making a face. Is that too much trouble for you to answer the phones, Dino? If it's too much trouble, I'll answer him in here. Fifth caller. Get tickets to the Jackson Browne, the Greek Theater, or Carrot Top, who I love. I know Carrot Top a long time. The Saban Theater, 800-222-5222. Fifth caller right now gets to go. Breaking news, by the way. Good news for Rex Tillerson. He already has a new job. He's a new colonel, I understand, for KFC. Can you imagine that? The big walkout is tomorrow, and LAUSD wants students to stay on campus during the gun violence walkout. Are they right in telling students they shouldn't walk out and participate in the march? I read a piece by a mom named Kathleen Wilson, who said she's the mother of two daughters in Marietta, Georgia, and she wants her daughter to lead a walkout on Wednesday and calling on Congress to act on gun reform, which is what it's about. My daughter's a high school senior, came home and told me she wanted to help spearhead the national school walkout at her school. I'm not ashamed to admit that it was unadulterated, pure bragging rights. Sadly, administrators in the school district we live in are not. So in her school district, they've notified students and parents that they're choosing to enforce disciplinary action for participants rather than choosing to use a teaching moment to further inspire. Now, a lot of schools are doing that. They're saying you're going to have an absence, and we're going to treat it as an absence if you don't show up. So you don't just get a free pass to go out and do this. What do you think? 800-222-5222. Now, I may have to wait a couple minutes because the lines are completely full with people who will want to win the contest. My take on this is I understand the school's approach for one reason. A, if they have a pre-existing policy in the district as far as protesting for any reason, and they adhere to that policy, I get it. Kids should not be punished for political speech. They should use it as a teaching moment. On the other hand, you can't just release students and say, see you later. They're obligated legally to make sure my kid is okay for the hours that they're supposed to be in school. So they got a safeguard against that. I would want parental permission and treat it as an absence. You're allowed to go out. We're not going to punish you for it, but treat it as an absence, because anytime anybody wants to protest or do something, then you have to make a special condition. No. Some schools, I'm sure, are going to have assemblies where they address the issue. But I would think a safety is the big, big issue. And for kids to just take off or disrupt the campus, the other thing is they do have a free speech. Just because, I think the Supreme Court said, just because you walk into a school doesn't mean that you are prohibited from free speech. However, in a school environment, if you're disruptive to education or you're disruptive to learning or the mission of the school, then the school is within their rights to punish you or intervene or decide how they want to deal with it. So it's not such a simple issue of, yeah, we understand that you want to be participatory in this. It's important. You do have the First Amendment rights. However, we have all these legal requirements to keep you safe and make sure that you're okay while you're supposed to be in school. So you're going to hear a lot of these stories that kids were told not to participate. Some are going to be punished. It goes school by school, district by district. Meanwhile, in Washington, they have this makeshift memorial made up of 7,000 pair of shoes on the U.S. Capitol that they put there today, as gun control activists want to dramatize the number of children killed in the United States by gunfire since the 2012 Sandy Hook school massacre. And the walkout is supposed to be tomorrow at 10 o'clock for 17 minutes, a minute each, to represent each of the students that were killed and staff at the Florida High School a month ago. And the fact that they want to push Congress, they want to make noise. It's hashtag enough national school walkout. It's organized by the activists who helped plan the Women's March in Washington for the past 2 years. So about 1,300 people below the age of 18 are killed by gunfire in the United States every year. So if it's my kid, I would probably say, yeah, I will get you out of school. I'll sign a note. You want to participate? You want to be part of this? Where are you going to go? How are you going to participate? What are you going to do? But I understand why most schools don't want to walk out, and they don't want the kids to disrupt the school and to disrupt the education in the school. I would hope that a lot of these places do have exercises planned. They do have, assemblies planned so they can talk about what's going on with the students, so they can hear the students, they can let them get up and speak, and they can hit them back with good answers to their questions. So it's important. It's definitely important. But remember, penalizing somebody for participating, not a smart thing, but just letting them walk out. I totally get why a lot of schools are freaked out by this, because it's their job to protect my kid, your kid. Talk Radio 790 KBC. Yeah, Talk Radio 790 KABC, Peter Tillman 10 continues. Hour number two, John in San Juan Capistrano. Congratulations. He's going to go see Jackson Browne, the Greek Theater, August the 4th. I just wanted, before I get out of here, I want to talk about this study. You know, we're talking about the kids tomorrow participating in the march, and they get together at 10 o'clock to talk about gun rights and to talk about the Florida shooting and to see if they can affect change. But a new study just says millennials spend 6 hours a day stressed out, okay? Poll of 1,000 millennials 18 to 25 found money, appearance, and career worries, as well as fears about the future, mean a large chunk of their time is spent feeling anxious or under pressure. 1 in 10 feel they have no one to turn to discuss their concerns, leaving them to face their fears alone. A further 67% admitted they had come across problems in their life where they felt they had nobody to lean on. As a result, 56% have ended up in more trouble after keeping a problem to themselves rather than confiding in someone else. May I say something about this study? That was us. That was you. That was everybody. Stop with these studies. 1 in 10 don't have anybody to turn to. My father, I think, talked to me 6 times in 11 years. I have nobody to turn to. Every generation has the same stuff. What they do is they put out these studies, and then everybody over 25 goes nuts and says they're snowflakes and they're this and they're that. Guess what? We were all the same. When you're 18 years old, you're narcissistic, you're anxious, you don't have money, you're worried about your parents because you want to sleep with somebody and not sleeping with you, and you don't know what you're going to do for a career. We're all the same. Every generation, if they had this kind of survey, would do the exact same thing. So it's the studies that crack me up rather than the fact that they're snowflakes, because I don't know that they're that much different than we were. I just don't think anybody asked us, because guess what? Nobody cared that much about how we felt or what we did. I was alone most of my life. I had a big nose, pompadour, and pimples. You think I didn't have worries and anxiety and what I'm going to do and when I'm going to see somebody naked of the opposite sex and what career I was going to have? So I love these studies that come out. And about we didn't have safe spaces. We didn't know what a safe space was. But yet most of the kids today, I don't think, care about safe spaces either. So everybody going to college is pretty anxiety ridden. And they're narcissistic, and they don't know what they're going to do. So these studies that keep coming out, especially the number 1 in 10 feel they have no one to turn to discuss their concerns. I barely have that now, and I'm married. So get over these studies where we demonize the millennials, because I think they're just like us. I think every generation was kind of the same. And if I'm a millennial, like I would march and say, stop doing these studies, because we are the same as you. And we all lived through tough stuff, different generations, and we all felt disenfranchised. The difference today is social media. They can connect with other people who they think are their friends, but they're not. But we were all about the same emotionally fragile, when we were teenagers. And we were then at 18, my mother would spit on a comb and make a pompadour on my head so that it would stay that way in high winds. Can you imagine? You think I felt disenfranchised? The only person who had it worse was Bob Saget, the comedian. I said, my mom used to spit on a comb and make my pompadour. And he said, really? At least your mom did that. My mom used to spit on my pompadour and then make it stick up with a comb. So I guess I was a lucky one. So nevertheless, 18 to 25-year-olds, I think, are pretty much the same as we were when we were 18 to 25. Money, appearance, career worries, the same stuff. No one to talk to, disenfranchised, alone. Yep, it's kind of the same. All right, talk radio 790 KABC. We'll do some crosstalk in just a moment.